Okay, listen up. Okay, lecture number 12, we're still on government. Part of the misunderstanding that's been going on is I didn't draw a big enough distinction between civil disobedience and revolution. Civil disobedience deals with bad laws. If there's one bad law here and one bad law there, it doesn't give you the right to revolt. Revolution deals with whether or not the government is a legitimate government. Dyser says if they're in power, they're a legitimate government. But I think that's a little bit too simplistic, because it seems that some governments do not. There are some organizations that call themselves governments do not protect the innocent man and punish the evildoer. It's the exact opposite, to where like some of these communist regimes where you butcher anybody who's had an economic course or two, and the most ruthless guys in your society, the most bloodthirsty guys, are rising to power, the Adolf Hitlers and people like that. Bear with me on this a little bit, because when we get to the just war criterion, a lot of the stuff that we're talking about is going to come out, because there's a lot of factors. Just because even if the government was an illegitimate regime, there's still other factors that would have to be determined before you would have the right to revolt. Okay? A passage, by the way, during the break that I went over with Kurt, I went over it like a savage, but the passage that I went over, the Bible says, wives, submit to your husbands as in everything. It's in Ephesians chapter 5, I don't know the exact verse, but look it up when you get there, but it says in everything. But if your husband commands you to murder an innocent person, don't think that that means that you're supposed to submit to him and murder that person. It doesn't. So in other words, the principle of the greater good, protecting the innocent human life, would outweigh the command to submit to your husband and everything. I think the principle of the greater good would hold. God says to submit to the governing authorities. Government can reach a point where it is no longer a legitimate regime, and then the principle of the greater good, God would raise up people from within to overthrow that government. Now, when Kurt and I were talking in the bathroom, Kurt said, how would you know you're going to win or not? And I said, it may be, and I'm not going to be talking about it, it may be that you don't know if it was called a God until you win. Although the legitimate regime had to come to power, the illegitimate regime had to come to power too. And the question comes up, were they legitimate when they came into power or not? And so we can't make a totally pragmatic test that if you win, it's from God, and if you didn't, it wasn't. Conrad brought up the fact that George Washington believed he was receiving visions from God about the American Revolution and was inspiring his leadership and directing him. Geiser would automatically disagree with that because he believes God can't give vision, or God doesn't give visions anymore. Okay? Not that he cannot, yeah.
Would one way to tell would be after it was said and done, then you say not just like who won or did it triumph, but like the fruit that comes from it?
Well, yeah, that could be a possibility. The consequences plus the fruit that comes, like who won, and then the one who won, what kind of regime is there? That's one of the things about it. If revolution is justified, is what you have to offer better than the government that's in existence right now. But then another thing too is, do you aid in the overthrow of a government, of a nasty government, because it's a threat to your government? Which Ronald Reagan felt that communists on our same landmass, like Nicaragua, was enough of a threat. So a lot of things come into play. Geiser's view about revolution, God gave this word to the government, not the citizens. Revolution is never justified. Schaefer's view, if a government becomes tyrannical, its citizens have the right to revolt. And again, I say I disagree with both of them. It's got to go beyond tyrannical. Now, the argument our founding fathers used was that you don't have a right to revolt against a tyrannical government. You have the obligation and the responsibility to overthrow a tyrant. But I think that's saying too much because Paul did not seem to be teaching that he had the responsibility of overthrowing Rome, which leads me to believe that you can have a government that is basically a tyranny, and at the same time it's still keeping order and protecting the innocent man for the most part and punishing the evildoer for the most part. But I do believe that there are times when God may raise up people from within a society and to form the new government. And at the same time, I don't want this to be confused with God using evil governments to perform some of his purposes. And what I might call an evil government, I might throw that around really, does not mean it's an illegitimate government. Rome was an evil empire, but it does not mean that it was an illegitimate regime. It was murdering, they were murdering and putting to death Christians at a later time than this. There was some smaller persecution, but later on they got horrible in their persecution. At the same time, I don't even think that automatically means revolution is allowed. There was an awful lot of innocent people that they were protecting. They just were not Christians at that time. I'm not saying I know exactly where the lines can be drawn, but keep in mind, I think all of us could agree there's at least one command that God gives in the Bible where he says, submit, wives submit to your husbands in everything, but then we would admit that there are exemptions from that command where there's no exceptions. And so if there's a command with no exceptions, but exemptions are given for the principle of the greater good, could it not be applied to such things as possibly divorce and remarriage, which Geisler doesn't apply it to, and could it possibly be applied to such things as revolution, which Geisler doesn't apply it to? And so I think those are areas that need more thought. I think Schaefer's answer was too easy, too black and white. I think Geisler's answer was too black and white. So I'll throw just a couple things out to you. Okay, God institutes all human government to serve a certain purpose. He doesn't do it in a vacuum. If we got five guys together and decided to juggle and we called ourselves a government, that doesn't mean that we're a government instituted by God. God institutes a government to have more than to be called a government. There's a purpose for it. And that purpose, certain purpose, is to protect the innocent and punish the evildoer. Now, if the government fails, and I'm talking like across the board, I'm not talking about in one instance they didn't get the bad guy or something. But if government fails to protect the innocent and punish the evildoer, God may raise up a new government from among the people. Just as God cast down the Canaanite governments in the Promised Land. There was an awful lot of governments that got it overthrown. Now let me say this, that was not a revolution. Because there was an invasion. They came from outside, okay? So that they were not revolution. It was not a revolution coming from within. It was an invasion where the Canaanite governments, but the thing is, you know, okay, now you're saying, yeah, but God instituted human government. God can decide to do that. Yeah, but what if God gave the desire to George Washington and our founding fathers to revolt? I think the questions are a little bit more gray than what Geisler and Schaefer are making.
But see, if we go along that period of George Washington and our founding fathers, wouldn't the same thing hold true now? Because aren't we basically going through the same thing now with our government, they went through them?
Well, I think that the case that the founding fathers made a Declaration of Independence is strong in some areas but weak in other areas. And I would say if I had to just that alone to go on, I would say it's doubtful that there would be a justified revolution. There are other factors, though. One thing we know, God does not want a one-world government. What was British imperialism doing at that time? They were establishing their empire as far as they could, and guys who were coming over here to get away from Great Britain found themselves just as much under Great Britain's control as they were before in another part of the globe. And imperialism is out of God's will. Now, which is more out of God's will? The revolution by our founding fathers or the imperialism of Great Britain? I don't know. But that wasn't, our founding fathers did not put that in their case. I think they would have had a stronger argument if they did. you know, it could have been, you know, it could have been Great Britain is trying to take over the whole world and just colonizing all over the place. And God says, I'm against that. I'm going to get these guys who are the wrong intentions and the founding fathers, and I'm going to get them to revolt, and I'm going to institute the kind of government I want, even though the guys who are doing it are doing it for the wrong reasons anyway. But what I'm saying is that I think just to make a blanket statement either way, I think it's just to go too far, is to make it oversimplify the issue. My view is God institutes all human government to serve a certain purpose, and the government across the board fails to protect the innocent and punish the evildoer, God may raise up a new government from among the people. Now,
there would have to be more to it, because I'm sure that Great Britain was still punishing the evil and protecting the innocent. I mean, they were not failing in that duty across the board. And plus, even at that time, France was still a major world power, and they had quite an empire themselves. So,
yeah, well, there's a lot of factors. What I'm saying is the case of founding fathers spelled out. Oh, you probably call it the question more of my principle than anything else. Maybe the idea of a one world government, maybe we should throw that in too. Because I know God wouldn't want, you know, it's against his perfect will at least for governments to just take over the entire globe. At the same time, though, if a government is, for the most part, protecting the innocent and punishing the evildoer, it seems to be for all practical purposes being a government, doing what the government's supposed to do. There's gray issues. There's hair splitting. But God did cast down the Canaanite governments in the Promised Land, but that wasn't revolution. There does seem to be an example of God instituting a revolution in the Bible. Take a look at 2 Chronicles, chapter 22. 2 Chronicles, chapter 22, verses 10 to 12. Got these big names again. Here we go. Now when Athaliah, the mother of Ahaziah, saw that her son was dead, she rose and destroyed all the royal offspring of the house of Judah. She wanted to rule over Judah. Israel had already had its civil war, and Israel was split in Judah to the south and Israel to the north. And she wanted to rule over Judah. But Jehoshabeath, the king's daughter, took Joash, the son of Ahaziah, that's the rightful heir to the throne, he's in the godly line, the messianic line, and stole him from among the king's sons who were being put to death, and placed him and his nurse in the bedroom. So Jehoshabeath, the daughter of King Jehoram, the wife of Jehoiada, the priest, for she was the sister of Ahaziah, hid him from Athaliah so that she would not put him to death. And he was hidden with them in the house of God 6 years, while Athaliah reigned over the land. Who reigned over the land at that time? Athaliah. Okay? Now, we go a little further. Now, obviously, God didn't institute that revolution. He usurped that authority. God didn't institute that. Take a look at 2 Chronicles 23:11-15. Then they brought out the king's son and put the crown on him and gave him the testimony and made him king. And Jehoiada and his sons anointed him and said, long live the king. When Athaliah heard the noise, now this is the one who was reigning, heard the noise of the people running and praising the king, she came into the house of the Lord to the people. And she looked, and behold, the king was standing by his pillar at the entrance, and the captains and the trumpeters were beside the king.
And all the people of the land rejoiced and blew trumpets, the singers with their musical instruments, leading the praise. And Athaliah tore her clothes and said, "Treason! Treason!" And Jehoiada the priest brought out the captains of hundreds who were appointed over the army and said to them, "Bring her out between the ranks, and whoever follows her, put to death with the sword." But the priest said, "Let her not be put to death in the house of the Lord." So they seized her, and when she arrived at the entrance of the horse gate of the king's house, they put her to death there. Now, she, in a kingship, this was no longer a theocracy, now you have a kingship in Israel from Saul on. The king is the government. The king reigns. She reigned over the land for 6 years, even though she had ruthlessly took it over. Now, yes, you have the messianic line being protected as well. But when you have little Joash being put back on the throne and then her being put to death, you basically have a revolution, and then you have the godly line back in power, and the Messiah eventually came, the Jewish Messiah eventually came through that line. It seems to me that God instituted this one revolution in the Bible and leaves open the possibility that there might be other justified revolutions.
Is that opinion based in part on the fact that it was the high priest that appears to have been running the whole thing, the whole revolution?
Even with that, the king is the head of the government. God reluctantly gave in to the people when they were pleading with Samuel the prophet. They didn't want to be, they didn't want to have a theocracy to rule everything by God. They wanted a king like the other nations. But once God gave in, the government of Israel became a kingship, and Saul reigned. And so, even though the Jewish high priest has more spiritual authority, the political authority, the authority of the government, where it resides in the king.
Well, I'm saying this revolution appears to have been led by Jehoiada the priest, because every verse of Jehoiada, the priest commanded, Jehoiada, the priest gave the captains, he gave to all the people. And then he put the new king on his back on his throne. It wasn't a king leading his own revolution. Is that something to do with it?
I would think so. I put down God instituted one revolution in the Bible.
Okay.
The fact, the way it was done, and by who, through who it was done,
right,
and the reasons why he did it.
Right.
Well, pretty much all Bible scholars agree that God did what's behind this revolution through the high priest. The question comes up, though, is that just the one exception, the godly line, or can there be other times when there's an illegitimate regime in power that God is raising people up to overthrow? Maybe the best argument for Great Britain is that they were an illegitimate regime, and that they had the right to rule Great Britain, but no right to rule in America. If that's the case, the Founding Fathers didn't use that argument, but British colonialism was what was going on, and maybe there should have been something they should have looked up to there, and maybe that's what would have made Great Britain an illegitimate regime in America. Then again, maybe they weren't an illegitimate regime, and maybe our Founding Fathers were just totally out of their will.
How about another comparison between this and the American Revolution? The next verse says that then Jehoiada made a covenant between himself and all the people and the king that they should be the Lord's people. Doesn't the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, probably not as strongly as Jehoiada's covenant, but doesn't that somewhat form a covenant between us and an obligation to...
I think that particular thing, what he's recognizing is we are still God's chosen nation.
Oh,
I think it goes back, special case for Israel.
Okay.
But yes, it would be nice if we would have the same view that our founding fathers and consider ourselves one nation under God.
Right.
But I think it gets beyond the actual issue itself.
Okay.
One of the frustrations with this is there should be hours of dialogue on each one of these, because we're getting into some real hair-splitting issues. Now, in my notes, I jotted this down. Again, the issue of British colonization, I didn't bring it up then, but I'm bringing it up now. But revolution should only be attempted as a last resort. If God did
call for revolution should be as a last resort, and that last resort may be self-defense. I mean, if the government is just letting the thugs walk the streets and then empowering the thugs, there's some people, and I don't know if they're off the wall or not, there's some people who are claiming that in America they want to start arming gang members and deputizing them and using them to make raids on houses of law-abiding citizens to search for guns or whatever. If America really gets to that point, and then allows them to keep the spoils as well, if America ever got to that point, could we really say that America was protecting the innocent and punishing the evildoer, or would it be the other way around? And also, the founding fathers were trying to make a case along those lines with the British soldiers, but if it was, that doesn't seem to be as wide. They didn't seem to make a case for it being as widespread as I think it would have to be for that to be the line. The other possibility we brought up a little earlier is that they might have been, it could have been a justified revolution for different reasons other than the reasons that they were given, yeah. So there's a whole lot of things that come into play. The most frustrating thing for me right now is just to try to cover this stuff and in the small amount of time possible. let's take a look at war and nuclear disarmament. We've got to look at the just war criterion, and this is going to answer a lot of the questions we had about revolution, and though we're probably raising more than the ones we even answered.
Can you speak of revolution that includes civil war also?
Not really. See, revolution, you take over the whole country. The people revolt and take over the country. Civil war, you got like one portion of the country fighting the other portion, and if the portion that wants out wins, you're going to have two separate countries probably.
So the revolution was really civil war.
Because what you have here is just, it was this peace here. There wasn't, we didn't have the same status as Great Britain. It wasn't, we were colonies of them, and these colonies revolted to get their freedom from them. I suppose you can make a case for the Confederacy. Even the Confederacy is more than colonies. There's a lot more that's entailed. Just war criterion. What this means is there such thing as a just war? Pacifists say there's no activism. This is what the way Geisler defines it. Activism says every war made by the government is right. If the government declares the war, it's right. And obviously, Geisler and myself, Schaefer, everybody would disagree with that. Christians. Pacifism says war is never right. And they act like handing Adolf Hitler a daisy would have saved 6 million Jewish lives. Okay? Selectivism. And then Churchill came on the picture, baby.
Thank you, baby.
So selectivism, some wars are just, and this is the correct view, I think there are some real good godly Christians that hold the view of pacifism. By the way, never compare the Christian church with a government. Remember the line we drew? It's not the government's job to give to welfare, it's the church's job. Because the early church did not have weapons and start their own military doesn't mean that we should argue that our government should get rid of all its weapons and get rid of our military. The state has the obligation to protect us. So never equate the church and the state. And don't use arguments for pacifism because the apostle Paul didn't carry an Uzi. Okay? We're talking apples and oranges here.
just war criterion. Hold to selectivism. Some wars are justified, and now we want to look at which of those wars are justified. So just war doctrine or just war criterion. Ambrose held to this. Augustine, after him, Aquinas, just about all the, and some of them made adaptions, different changes to some of the factors. But number one, first, has got to be a just cause. Now, we're not talking about revolution only. We're talking about all war. It's got to be a just cause. In other words, a sufficient reason to engage in war, such as self-defense, or to protect innocent life, or in defense of human rights. Okay? There's got to be sufficient reason to engage in the war. So just cause. Number two, I question this one. Competent authority. Geisler holds to it, so he's going to say, basically what it means is government only can wage war, not private groups. I think, though, God can... The only way I will accept this is if, with my present understanding, that is, if God raises up a competent authority, a government from within the people, to then have the just revolution, if a just revolution was called for, okay? In other words, the founding fathers would have been the government that God instituted for America and not Great Britain. But the idea, if we just say government, not private groups, in the most wooden, literal way possible, then that would automatically rule out. That would automatically rule out revolution. I will throw another passage actually here. Genesis 14:11-16. Lot, the nephew of Abraham, was taken captive. Abraham, who at that time had not had a nation yet, he didn't have a nation. He was just a Abraham was just a family guy, you know, and he had some slaves and stuff like that. Well, four kings took Lot captive, took him hostage, and Abraham sent out his well-trained servants, defeated the four kings in battle, and got them back. Was Abraham a government at that time? No. So, I question the competent authority aspect, because it seems like sometimes God can use, like in the case of Abraham, ordinary people to knock off governments, knock off nations. Now, they weren't revolting, they just wanted Lot back. But they had an act of war, basically, fought them in battle, defeated them in battle, and these were just Abraham's servants. They weren't a government. Comparative justice. Justice. If we said you had to be perfect, your government, then you know nobody would be able to go to war because nobody's perfect. This is like with Matthew 7 verses 1 to 5 against hypocritical judging. You can't pull the splinter out of somebody else's eye if you got a log in your own eye. Okay? Your nation must be more just than the other nation. If Saddam Hussein is killing some innocent people in his society, that wouldn't justify Adolf Hitler and the Third Reich invading him, because Adolf Hitler was killing more people than him. For that matter, it says a lot about Stalin. We were justified in trying to get Stalin's aid, because we supposedly didn't know what everything that was going on with Stalin. But Stalin wasn't justified in fighting Hitler because he was killing more people than even Hitler was. And he had the same agenda that Hitler did, but they were taking their time about it because they weren't militarily prepared to do what Hitler was trying to do on a worldwide scale. But comparative justice. You don't slam one country for killing a few innocent people when you're killing a lot of innocent people. Really, really makes you wonder about America with her abortion right now. How poor we are right now to compare ourselves with other nations. Of course, there's some nations that are even slimier than us right now. Right intention, number four, right intention. You can have them. There could be a good reason for it and all, but right intention means a desire for peace or for restraining evil or assisting good. Now, supposing we have on paper, we say, look at all the lives we're saving, and it would be a just war. However, the real reason why we're getting into it was because our businesses were being destroyed. Like, a lot of people made that accusation about Vietnam. I don't think that's
all.
That, what's that?
The Gulf War, too.
The Gulf War, a lot of people make that accusation about that. And I don't think it was the case in either one, but let's just say that the real intention was money. Then, even if you had a just cause and a competent authority, and we were more just than them, it would still be the wrong intention. It wouldn't be a just war. Number five, last resort. Last resort. You know, Clinton's bombing people, and we never did remove the arms embargo. Last I heard, I don't know if they,
no.
And the situation, and you know, there's some other. We could arm people and help them to defend themselves before we even send our own troops over, and that might be an option. Last resort. Number six, the probability of success. Let's say you're in the most ruthless regime of all time. But they're so ruthless that they're the only ones that own weapons. And you've only found 50 people in this empire that have the guts to revolt. Only an idiot would do it. Your probability of success is so low. There's no probability. There's like virtually no possibility of success. Again, last resort, all peaceful means, all peaceful terms have been exhausted, but probability of success, you don't need certainty, but don't spill blood when you know it's going to be in vain. And again, just in this case of war, okay, supposing Ronald Reagan was right and the Sandinistas were an illegitimate regime. And supposing it was just for him to back the Contras and try to overthrow that regime and try to bring that regime down, why wouldn't Reagan be justified in starting a war with Russia? Well, we used the same reasons that we used on Vietnam. Let's say Vietnam was just, and I believe it was. It was just handled all wrong. Well, let's say that it was just and stop us for the economy. Why not just go right to this, right to the source, and then take out either China or Russia?
You're not about to do that one.
It's a probability of success. I mean, we're talking. We're not even talking about just winning. We're talking about coming out of it better shape than the world coming out of it in better shape than before time. So even if you win, say, yeah, we won. Okay, we got 12 Americans left. Russia's totally wiped out. The radiation leakage is spreading throughout Europe.
But we won.
We won the war, though, you know. So probability of success. Also what is called proportionality. Proportionality. What that means is the good to be achieved, the good that you hope to achieve by the war must outweigh the evil that will result by it, okay? For instance, supposing it was Saddam Hussein who found out he killed 10,000 people, 10,000 innocent people, and we decided, well, what we're going to do is we're going to go there and send our bomber planes, and we're going to drop nukes, and we're going to wipe out the entire nation. Well, because of the way he killed 10,000 people, now we're going to kill millions of innocent people. I agree with a well-argued case. He holds a just war criteria. He agrees with me that there is a time when revolution will be called for as well. His name is Al Martino. His book is The Moral Use of Nuclear a fighting chance, the moral use of nuclear weapons. A Catholic scholar, a retired colonel from the Air Force, got a PhD in, something in war tactics or something. I agree with him, and he believes that the bombs that we dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki were unjustified.
Unjustified?
Yeah, we had the means available to us to where we could have hit strictly military targets or military-related targets such as factories, making things where we did not have to wipe out cities, and that it was a tactic. We basically stooped, during World War II, the Allies stooped to the level of Adolf Hitler. And two wrongs don't make a right. And when I first read that, every part, every American bone in my body wanted to revolt against that. But he made a real good case for him.
Well, I was an interesting conversation that I had the other day with the training officer, a unit commander, and he's heavy into that kind of stuff too. And we were talking about nuclear weapons, and he was making the cases not for total disarmament. I mean, he believes that we should keep some, but because we have the ability and the means today to wage conventional war, especially with things like fuel air explosives, which will cause the same amount of damage as a tactical nuke, but without the radiation or anything like that. We have the ability today to wage that kind of a conventional war with smart weapons that make not nuclear weapons obsolete, but an unjustified weapon of to use.
He needs to read Al Martino's book, The Moral Use of Nuclear Weapons, a Fighting Chance, The Moral Use of Nuclear Weapons, and Ronald Reagan was really squared away when it came to... Ronald Reagan wanted us to have the capability of winning limited nuclear wars, and that is the direction you have to go. When the technology is there, the day is going to come when everybody's going to have them, and so you have got to get the technology to win, and that would take a Star Wars defense system. When somebody invents the sword, you are obligated to try to invent the shield. That's number one. Number two, Ronald Reagan wants to go with many more nuclear warheads, but smaller ones and more accurate ones with smaller radiation fallout, with less fallout, so that you could hit strict military targets. Ronald Reagan's plan was so that if we got hit with a first strike, his plan was that if we would have got Star Wars done on these weapons and make them more mobile so they can't target them in a first strike, if the Soviets are hit us with a first strike, we would knock out 998 out of everyone, and Robert Jackson said we had that technology. The smart bullet technology is all we would need, and we had that even in the 60s and 70s. But if you start a four-tier defense, each one would knock out four out of five warheads, which means by the time when you send 1,000, only two would get through, and that's conservative figures, and it would do so little damage. But then comes the payback, and every one of our warheads would hit strategic targets such as bridges where ammunition can be moved, would target bases, nuclear bases, and you know, right down the line. Basically, it would mean we would never get into that scenario because the Russians could see on paper that the Soviet Union could see on paper that it was...
Well, what I'm saying is, I mean, you know, he believes in deterrence too. That's a very thing. But the use of tactical nuclear weapons today is not as justified as it used to be because we have the ability now to do the same thing.
Yeah, okay,
conventional
weapons. Let me clear this up. I wasn't going to get into it, but... Let me clear this up. Martino. I get Martino and Antonio mixed up. Two Italian guys, both Catholics, one wrote against AIDS. Martino is the guy that wrote this one. Don't ever confuse, and this is what we've done from even before Jimmy Carter Day, back from the Kennedy times. A deterrent is not a defense. A deterrent is not a defense. If the commander in chief says it is, don't listen to him. He's lying through his teeth. A deterrent is not a defense. If you do not have the ability to win a war and to come out of it in good shape, you do not have a defense. All a deterrent is a bluff. mutually assured destruction, that whole policy is a deterrent. It's a bluff. If you start pushing buttons and nukes on us before our nukes get blown up, we're going to start pushing buttons and we're going to wipe you off the face of the globe. So you won't push buttons because then we're like, well, wait a minute. The Soviets might call our bluff. They might say, Jimmy Carter is not going to kill our innocent people just because we decided to take out his military bases. With a deterrent, you bluff, and then if your bluff is called, your choice is suicide or surrender. With a defense means you have the capability of winning a war. Ronald Reagan wanted us to get us out of the Jimmy Carter and John F. Kennedy nuclear deterrent stage and into the nuclear defense stage, where we could win a nuclear war if we had to. And that, my friend, is the only way that we can be sure that it's not going to happen. The only time a nation doesn't get invaded is when it is totally obvious that if you invade them, you are going to get wiped out and you're not even going to put a scratch on it.
So in a nutshell, deterrent is to prevent action, where defense is to defeat the action.
No. No. Because a defense is a better deterrent than a deterrent is. So in other words, a deterrent is a bluff. A defense is, hey, we're not bluffing.
You want to
come, go ahead, but we ain't bluffing. We can win this thing, and we can win it big.
Right.
You send a missile. So in other words, a defense is a deterrent plus a defense. A deterrent is only a deterrent.
Well, but something that's merely a deterrent is something that you hope will prevent an action from being taken against you.
A deterrent, if the bluff is called,
and you lose, you're going to lose either way, yeah. But it's just a bluff. There's nothing really.
Right.
Defense, if they call your bluff, if you want to call it a bluff, you can win. That's what Ronald Reagan wanted. That's what Ronald Reagan said, we can win. And people in the press were screaming.
Because
he's saying we can win a nuclear war with Russia. But that's what he's talking. He's not talking about hitting innocent civilians. He's talking about strict military targets. Let's get number 8 and then we'll close the lectures. Number 8, the proportionality, again, is the good to be achieved by the war must outweigh the evil that will result by it. And then number 8 is discrimination. Discrimination. What discrimination means, you have to hit military targets, not innocent civilians. Now, a so-called innocent civilian, like many of us here, when we go to work at PSNS or Bangor, we become legitimate targets. And you want a nice, secure government job when you're working on a military base, that makes you a target. But discrimination, military targets, not innocent civilian. You don't kill innocent people. I believe Proverbs 6:16-19 deals with that. By the way, the probability of success and the proportion, Luke chapter 14, verses 31-32, Jesus said you count the cost before you build or before you go to battle. Right intention, and as a last resort, Romans 12:18, as so long as it depends on you, be at peace with all men. But those are the 8 criteria: just cause, competent authority, comparative justice, right intention, last resort, probability of success, proportionality, and discrimination. Let me say this. If you go by that criteria, a lot of the wars that God commanded in the Old Testament would be unjust wars, because he killed innocent people. Okay? So what does that mean? It means that all these thinkers, Ambrose, Augustine, Aquinas, all these people needed to insert another principle. But what it comes out to is, oh, by the way, a just war might still be fought unjustly. I think World War II was a just war, but at times we fought unjustly when we stooped to their levels. But anyway, a God-ordained war overrides just war criteria. Let me repeat that. A God-ordained war overrides just war criteria. Job 121, the Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away. The Lord is the giver of life. If he says kill every man, woman, and child, a God-ordained war would override any just war criteria. Okay? He is the just cause. I mean, if God told the Israelites, wipe out all of them and their livestock and everything, a God-ordained war overrides just war criteria. And you find it in Deuteronomy chapter 20, verses 16-18, and Joshua 10:40. I believe those passages are talking about where God is ordering that type of thing.
What would you do
again? Deuteronomy 20, verses 16 to 18, and Joshua 10, 40. But that's what, basically what I'm talking about as far as war. So these things, probability of success, discrimination, these things would also, just cause would have to also be considered. If there is the possibility of revolution being justified, you would have to still meet this, these criteria as well for just war. Plus, add the condition of God-ordained war overrides just war criteria. Don't get in the business of calling God a sinner. And, okay, that's it for that.